Welcome to Spark Your Fire podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Now, here's your host, Jazz and David. But before that, let's listen to the quote of the week.
Here's the key. Learn from every mistake, because every experience, encounter, and particularly your mistakes are there to teach you and force you into being more of who you are. And then figure out what is the next right move. What is your true calling? What is your dharma?
G'day everyone, welcome back to another episode of Spark Your Fire. I'm your host, Dave Shee, living in the lucky New South Wales, Sydney, at the moment. And look, I'm not going to give my co-host, Jazz, a hard time. I know I've given him lots of hard time already, but this time our guest is also in Victoria, so I'm going to play safe a little bit here. Having said that, Jazz, how are you doing, mate?
Good, mate. Stop bragging about New South Wales, please.
Yeah, very subtle about that kind of stuff. It's part of an art. That's good. Okay, it's all right. But look, we have today basically a guest that came back from last time due to popular demand. And this guy was, I think we should say, a survivor from a mining downturn. He bought in the mining town, you know, a few years ago back, and, you know, he started his property, I think from memory, about 19 when you're very early. Yeah. And then unfortunately, you know, took on the wrong advice from the trusted advisor at that point in time, bought in mining town, had a bit of downturn, and at the moment still kind of recouping that loss. So, you know, we've got Daniel Hain back on the show today. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks, brother. How are you?
Yeah, we're good, mate. We're good. Lovely to have you back on the show. Let's put it that way. You know, it's always been an inspiring story from last time. We had really some positive feedback as well in terms of your story, given the fact that, you know, you have been knocked down, you have been knocked hard in that, but you haven't given up hope and you bounced strong. So
knocked down, jump back up. Let's keep going.
That's it. So it's good. So, you know, I reckon our audience love your mentality, love your excitement, love your passion about the property. That's why we'll bring you back on today to share a bit more about your journey. Obviously, what you've been doing since then, and I know last time we touched on the fact that you've had you were looking at a 1-2 subdivision. And that was pre-COVID, of course. And now that COVID kicked in, what's happening with that property? Actually, just start off with that.
Yeah, so that property there is still tracking along. I thought we would have been at the stage of already having it sort of developed. So we're past the advertising stage. That usually takes sort of 2 weeks to sort of get a response from council. And we're now at sort of 7 weeks at the moment and still waiting on the final sort of response of the permit and the conditions. So there's not a lot happening on that. I can start renovating the house if I wanted to on the external, but I'm not going to because of, I think we may have to, there may be a few conditions that we have to meet and I don't want to double do work in a way. So that's just sort of staying put at the moment.
Until the council approval comes down.
So it's just tricky here in Melbourne at the moment. Everyone's working slow. Everyone's working remotely. And it definitely is impacting a lot of applications and stuff like that at the moment, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I don't blame you.
So being active in the market currently, Daniel, how are you finding the Victorian market amid all this chaos that we are dealing with?
At the very moment, I think in the present time, I don't think the property market has seen any significant drop in value. If anything, I think it's counterintuitive and it's sort of going up in price, like somewhat. Like some areas, there's actually higher demand. As we sort of spoke a little bit previously before we jumped online there, I think there's a lot of less tyre kickers in the market at the moment and there's more serious buyers. So when the agents are presenting deals and stuff to like their list of hot buyers, they're ready to go. They're pre-qualified and I'm finding a lot of deals are transacting very fast at the moment. But I think the real issue not just in Victoria and probably more Australia-wise, is the government was so quick to hand out all stimulus packages and all that. Some people are actually making more money now than what they were pre-COVID because they've actually got all their mortgages on hold, on a mortgage holiday, and some people being on JobKeeper are on more of a money at the moment. So the really big losses and stuff haven't been shown yet, and I think we're up for tough times in the near future. Mm-hmm. I haven't got a crystal ball to say where it's all going to go. I don't think it's going to drop 40-50% like some people are saying. I just cannot see that going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Not with the support that is being provided. Like you just mentioned, the JobKeeper, JobSeeker suspensions, all of them all together will buy enough time to navigate the markets, basically, or the tough times.
Yeah, I think so, mate. I think so, yeah. So, yeah, no, I think the future won't be as dim as people say. I think it's great for investors like myself and you guys and the listeners to catapult and take advantage of a lot of these situations out there and actually position ourselves a little bit further by being aware of opportunities. So, yeah, definitely going to be more opportunities out there.
If would you be buying today as an investor, Dan? Just out of curiosity.
Would be buying today. Yeah.
What sort of deal would you be looking at?
Depends on your cash flow and your equity position, I suppose. Like everyone's situation's different. Personally, my situation, I don't have enough sort of capital to be buying a lot of long-term assets at the moment, even though they may be cheap, but it's going to sort of impact me. So I'm definitely okay with putting some more money into short-term projects. I do want to look to sort of get into property development, sort of the townhouse sort of stuff as well, and that's what I've been concentrating a lot on. And my first project too, I'm happy to put some money in there to sort of show I've got skin in the game as well as raising money through investors. I think that's a really good strategy as well. I think it depends on your equity position. I'm sure people are going to be able to go out there and buy some properties 20% below market value and in the near distant future be able to get an uplift from when the market comes back up and catapult forward. It just depends on people's goals and people's visions, I suppose, to actually what they want to do,
But let me play devil's advocate a bit. I mean, if we're talking about that, the trend that we're currently seeing, and this is not just Victoria, this is kind of across Sydney, I'm seeing to a degree, and Brisbane to a degree, the owner-occupiers are obviously batting hard in there. And they're willing, they don't do the numbers, right? They act on emotions. Okay, so that's why a lot of times the numbers are still holding up to a degree because the owner-occupiers are still holding the fort. Now, as an investor, you focus on crunching numbers, and that's why I said, as an investor today, let's just say assume that you want to buy and hold, and if you cannot get it below market value and you had to compete with owner-occupiers, would you be looking at investing in the current period of time?
I think I would if I had the capital. I'm a big believer that there's no better time to buy than yesterday.
You would disregard whatever the current situation is. You would still say, look, as long as it makes sense, as long as numbers stacks up, I would still buy property when I can.
I would,
Good. That's a good philosophy. I think, and the reason I ask that is because there's a lot of people that's just sitting on the side fence, right? As you can imagine, they're like, oh, well, I don't really want to jump in because of the fact that, number one, we don't know what's going to happen to the property market moving forward. Of course, nobody knows. No one's got a crystal ball. Secondly, if you had to potentially overpay because of the fact that you've got so much competition, there's no stock, there's a lot of demand for people who want to buy the property. And if you cannot get it below market value, what's the point of being a property investor trying to cut into the market at this point in time? It's a bit like the share trading type of mentality. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like, I'll try to buy at the bottom.
And a lot of people I've seen that have built quite a large portfolio, it's all sort of it's not so much the property itself, it's a finance game as well. And if you can afford to get in the property and if the property makes sense as an investor and it's part of your puzzle, piece of the puzzle, and you can finance it at that point of time, get into it. Because you don't know what's going to happen in the finance in 3 to 6 months as well. So that's my strategy. That's my outlook on it. Yeah.
I think it always goes back to the same thing. Basically, if you can, one, buy at the right price in the right area at the right time, which you can call this a bad time or the right time, because if you can negotiate hard, then it's the right time.
And the thing is, too, I suppose, if you're competing with owner-occupiers, that's maybe a good thing, too, because there's less investors out there. So at the same stage, too, there's actually more chance for creating more opportunity as an investor. Like, as an astute investor, if there's a lot of investors not looking, I think it's more of a numbers game to create more opportunity for yourself. Like, because in a booming hot market, people are going to pay too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you done many projects with the OPM, other people's money, or joint ventures kind of thing? Or
yeah, I have, and that's sort of how I sort of started out, I suppose, because after the mining schmozzle, it sort of left us with a bit of a small bank account, I suppose, to sort of get started. So the first one we funded ourselves, like, which was tight, so we funded that one ourselves. I think I talked about that one on the previous podcast. The second sort of project that I sort of done, I was keen to get back into the market, like straight away. And so I started doing some more letterbox drops. Got a phone call from a vendor, went out there, met him. And I had a money partner teed up previously, like even before I started doing the letterbox drops. And that was my auntie. She was pretty keen to get into the investing space, I suppose. So we come up with an agreement where she would get the loan for the property. She would pay all the cash to contribute towards a property. And my role was to renovate the property. So I negotiated it, I renovated it, and I managed the sale. And, so within sort of 3 months, we made together, I think, about $67,000, $68,000. We sort of split that in half, 50% each.
Nice.
Are you seeing people or the investors basically with money happy to take the risk or not at this point in this market at the moment?
A lot of people still are because other investment classes have been smashed, right? So property's still quite a safe sort of thing. Like, it still comes with a lot of risk at the very moment, but I've built what's called a little black book, I suppose. So from all the little networking events and stuff I've been to and all that sort of stuff, I've collected everyone's business cards and try to stay in contact with people and send regular emails to people. And mate, there's people out there with money and there's still people out there willing to throw money into projects at the moment. So besides COVID and all stuff like that, my lack of issue with the problem, my problem at the current issue is not having another project to sort of throw money into. It's not the money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finding it more harder to find a good quality project than finding
it's
the money.
It's the deal, isn't it? It's the deal. Yeah. It's not you're not short of people, you're short of deals at the moment.
Yeah.
And that's obviously because of the lockdown that you can't do all the required legwork to find those projects, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I found that hard at the very moment. Melbourne's restrictions, I think, have made my strategy a little bit harder. So my strategy's been letterbox dropping, has been Facebook advertising, has been, just a few sort of other ways, like even agents, I suppose. But then now a lot of vendors, like, because I sent out the other day, I think it's 350-odd letters, targeted letters where I walk the streets and handle them into properties that I liked, where I've tried to outsource before and I'm sure they just put them in the bloody, in the local bin. I've done that myself, but 350 letters and not even a phone call. Which is quite surprising, So it doesn't mean that I'm not going to get a phone call in the near distant future too. That's happened quite a lot as well. But, so it is a numbers game. I think you just got to keep getting the letters out there. But even at the very moment, so many people are so cautious to actually bring someone random into the house. Yeah, that's what I'm finding.
What was the strike rate before? Like when you had 150, what kind of rate?
I was getting at least 5-6 phone calls. Yeah, okay. Yeah, at least 5 or 6 phone calls to sort of that amount of letters.
Pre-COVID, but now it's down to zero and you're thinking just potentially.
Yeah. And to be honest, I've changed the letter types quite a few times and I have had more success with the basic letter. As I try to evolve and grow and try to make a bit more of a sophisticated letter, I'm actually finding that not working as well, to be honest.
So to be simple, make it simple, down to basics.
Yeah, so if you get a lawyer to fucking write you a letter, it doesn't mean you're going to, you're more going to scare people, I think. That's what I'm taking from it last time. I put a lot of emphasis on writing about COVID in the letter, writing about the bushfires, writing about how there's other solutions to sort of other people's problems. And, I've actually done quite well with a letter with spelling mistakes and stuff in the past. People think it's more genuine too.
So you have obviously burnt your hands in the mining town, and thanks for sharing the story last time on that one.
Yeah.
How would you use your experience from the lessons learned in the past in this current environment, which is pretty hard to navigate?
Yeah, I think it's quite simple, really. Like when I lost all my money in the mining town, and the thing was too, I had so much trust in someone else and another strategy that provided as an expert. One thing I've learned is it's very easy to lose the money and very hard to make the money. So now's the point of time as well that you really want to be cautious of where you're buying, when you're buying as well. So previously I was just talking, now's a good time to buy. It doesn't mean everywhere is a good time to buy. Everywhere in Melbourne is a good time to buy at the moment. Like the fundamentals have to stack up as well. Right? Mm-hmm. So you got to make sure that there's still some steady employment in that area. Can people still afford their mortgages and stuff like that? Just sort of stuff like that. I genuinely think, with the right outlook on it, I would still be buying, but I'd be cautious of who you're taking the advice from. And I'm a big expert of sort of doing education as well. Don't just jump into it willy-nilly and don't take advice from anyone else. You've got to sort of do your own research as well. And it may take you a year to sort of start monitoring a bit about the property market as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you played in the commercial space at all or residential only?
No, only residential I've sort of invested in, yeah.
Right. Okay. Any thoughts in general on commercial, speaking to your circle or network of people?
Well, commercial is definitely a good aspect. A guy I know, like for an example, he bought a Bridgestone tyre shop. Previously, it was rented through a different tyre shop, I think, and it was way under market rent. He then had a good finger on the pulse of the suburb. He then found a national tenant to take over the new lease. He signed it on an option contract as well. So he had a longer settlement sort of thing, but he didn't even have to settle on it because he had the option there. He then found the national tenant. They then paid an extra $30,000 a year in rent, and that $30,000 a year in rent at about a 10% yield is a $300,000 uplift.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a phenomenal sort of deal because therefore he refinanced and he got back all his money that he put into the project upon settlement. So commercial can be a good thing, but there's a lot to learn in that as well. And I don't think it's just – if I was buying commercial too, I'd be taking the skills that I've got from my renovation skills to sort of how can I increase the rent to therefore increase the value, because that's how commercial works. As soon as you increase the rent, that increases the yield – and therefore that increases your value. So is that renovating the property? And a lot of times you don't even have to renovate the actual commercial asset. It's get a better quality tenant in there. So you have to be have your finger on your pulse there. It's something that I would love to get into a bit later down the path when I've got a bit more cash and equity sort of behind me, because I think it's the type of thing where you need – I don't want to be very highly leveraged in something like that as well, because let's face it, if they are vacant, they're going to possibly be vacant for a hell of a lot more than just an average house.
Fair point.
So that's my thoughts of it,
Any particular – so you are just – looking at the Victorian market, correct, in terms of finding the projects, right?
Yeah, correct. I've got a few properties in Queensland, but, Victoria is my main focus at the moment,
Any particular suburbs or territory that you stay focused on or prefer over the others, if you don't mind sharing? Or
yeah, that's okay. I'm a big advocate of the western suburbs, so like Melton, Werribee, Wyndham Vale, all those sort of areas, Sunshine. I just like the western suburbs a lot, purely A, I live over that side of town, B, it's more affordable than the eastern suburbs and northern suburbs. And I look at it this way too, like in Melton where I live, they're selling houses out here like hotcakes, and that's not just because the dirt's better. The dirt's actually real shit out here. It's dry as hell, but it just means it's more affordable. So it's like Hyundais. They sell more Hyundais than they do Lamborghinis, and that's just purely because of an affordability thing. So I think long term, you're always going to have good solid rental yield with a good solid capital growth, because it is affordable. It is not too far away from the city. Got good infrastructure and stuff out the western suburbs, Like, we've got the biggest Bunnings in Melton coming here to this, southern hemisphere. Like, killer. Yeah. Can't argue with that, Like, we're going to have a big shot, a big hospital put on out here soon. So a lot of big infrastructure and stuff getting put out here. And a lot of investors too, I suppose, that think to themselves, oh, I want to buy something $800,000, $900,000. Well, maybe you could buy three properties over here instead of just having one, But Pasco Vale, I'm starting to look over in that area, Pasco Vale, Faulkner, to sort of do townhouse developments. That's where I'm starting to put a lot of my efforts into. I was looking in Sunshine sort of area, but one thing that I've sort of noticed in that area, in the townhouse space, they seem to sell quite cheap, the townhouses, and it doesn't cost much more difference to build a townhouse if you're talking Pasco Vale to Sunshine, like trusses, concrete to concrete, plaster's plaster. Obviously, the fixtures and fittings will change a little bit, but the end sale price in some of these other areas can be $250,000 per townhouse. And yes, you're going to pay a little bit more for the site, but maybe only $250,000-$300,000 more for the site. And if you're talking five townhouse site, it's actually not that much more. Yeah, that's my concentration. That's my little pockets.
With the no to low level of migration currently, is that making you, as an investor, concerned while picking up some of these projects?
Not really. Not really. A lot of the projects that I've sold to, heaps of projects I've sold before have been a mixture of people. I've sold to sort of, people coming, like migrants, I suppose, to first home buyers, Australian first home buyers. I've sold to everyone. And, it doesn't really bother me so much. Obviously, more people coming into the country and stuff like that, yes, of course it's going to increase the demand for property. It's just as simple as that, supply and demand. But no, it's not really bothering me, I suppose,
Projects that you're currently looking at, would you sell them once the project is over, the subdivision or the construction, or you will consider renting them out, basically?
Yeah, the subdivision one that we're doing, look, the plan is to hold them. hold them, release the equity and throw the equity into other properties. As we've sort of discussed as well, I don't exactly know what's going to happen with finance in the near distant future. You know, finance may be harder. So that's where I'm open to selling if I have to as well, so long as it's going to redeploy me further than currently like where I'm at. Obviously, I'd like to hold the assets a little bit longer. If I see more opportunities and more potential in selling and putting them into other projects that maybe I can flip or, yeah, like for an example, that subdivision project that we've got now, turning it from one into two, we've sort of built our portfolio up by selling some properties. Mm-hmm. You know, like had I not released the equity and sold some properties, I wouldn't have been able to build as big of a portfolio as I've got because my construction job doesn't pay that much.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have taken too long to save up to get into another property. So sometimes we've been able to throw the money into a property and then therefore that gets us into a few. That's that's sort of what's helped me, I suppose, because I've got a glass ceiling in my construction job, and to get a pay rise in that, it's sort of, I suppose, more chance of God bloody coming down here and giving me a slab of beer.
Sorry, David, you had a question before.
Yeah, no, I was gonna say you did mention that obviously Jazz asked a question about the no money down strategies that you had, and I think you had a few up on your sleeve. Is that right? Would you be open to share a few tips and tricks about these no money down strategies that you've done so far with our listeners?
Yeah. So I think tips and tricks, I suppose, of what I've sort of learned is
find the aunt.
Sorry?
Find an auntie.
Find an auntie.
Find an auntie.
And my auntie's helped out with one project. I've had other equity partners throw money in through other investment groups and stuff that I've met. It's amazing to the amount of people that are interested in throwing money into projects. I've been at work before and I've got a site foreman, like he's the project manager of the site that we're working on. I'm showing him some photos. The next second, he's a $100,000 investor. You know what I mean? Like, and he would have been the last guy that you would have thought is keen to throw a project in. So you got to talk proud. You got to be bold and out there talking to people, at a consistent basis, I suppose. It does help if you've got some runs on the board. But there was a time when I didn't as well. So I'm no much different than a lot of the other people, and I'm not Superman, that's for sure. So I guess some tips and tricks as well, if you're dealing with a vendor, I suppose, an off-market sort of deal, be very patient with them as well at times. Don't be extremely pushy. Be open and flexible. Be honest. Have good integrity. That is a really important thing. Like no one likes that greasy car salesman. sometimes I've had a negotiation with a vendor that's lasted 8 months before, right? And then it took 8 months to negotiate, and it wasn't me hammering him every Wednesday. Like it was just every now and then we'd touch base. After 8 months, he said, "Daniel, you were the only genuine guy that's not trying to rip me off." Even though I was offering him a really cheap sort of price, but the price I offered him was based upon the scope of works on the house, the condition of the house. It was quite a dilapidated condition.
It's fair, basically.
So, actually having anyone else in the negotiation, I've been a bit greedy, but my integrity, I suppose, over the long period of time paid off. We come up with a good negotiation. We ended up getting a 9-month settlement with a $5,000 deposit. That one there was no option contract or anything like that. That was just a contract of sale with a really long settlement. So there was a stamp duty triggered that got paid on that. But that's not an upfront cost as well, right? So stamp duty gets paid when you sell the property. And we done a 9-month settlement. That was funny too, because I didn't even know how I was going to buy that. Like, how I was going to fund that renovation. That was $100,000 of renovation money. So I signed the contract, had that big black book of people ready to go. It took me about a month to sort of get the money in place. We got the funding. We started the projects. We got it done within about 3 months. We put it on the market and we've done a simultaneously settlement where we had the two settlements on the same day. I bought off the vendor and someone bought off me. And that particular transaction, we got the highest price in the area for a three-bedroom house. We absolutely smashed it out of the park. We turned an absolute, like a real rough piece of shit into a nice diamond. It was great.
I think
also be very clear on your sale price as well. You've definitely got to be clear on that. If you're doing a joint venture with a landowner and stuff like that, there's a lot of risk. There really is. There can be a lot of risk because at the end of the day, say you buy something for $300 and you're planning to sell it for $450, and if you get it all done, you've just put $60,000 into the renovation and you've got a few other costs and you're only going to get $350 on the end price, what do you do then? So you've got to have those contingencies and all that stuff there, and you've got to have all that stuff thought about. Are you actually going to cop the loss? Like, is that how it works? Like, there's a lot to think about there. So very fortunately, I've never had that happen where we've done a deal and it's sort of gone backwards on the back end. But it's always a thought of yours. Like, even though you do so much research and so many comparables and all that, I've still always had that thought, fucking hell, if this gets all the way to the end and we don't make a dollar, yes, we have had some, procedures in place to sort of cover those. But it's all part of it. It's all part of investing as well. And it's all part of your due diligence to sort of show the vendor. And that's where I say you're part of your integrity too. I never tried to hide from the vendor exactly what we're going to make. I don't show them probably the absolute highest price that I'm trying to achieve, but just enough that it's quite a fair deal that, you know, like if someone was to buy it, well, that's all that they would have made anyway.
How about the... Just on the David's question, basically, how about the legal side? How do you handle the legal side of it?
Sometimes contracts, sometimes agreements, like a joint venture agreement, So, like, other times we might do a deal with the vendor and we have, like, a longer settlement and you do a joint venture agreement where, therefore, they allow you to sort of come in and renovate the property with your money and then on sell it, but on sell it through them, not on sell it through you, right? So that's an agreement, and therefore that doesn't trigger the sort of stamp duty that can be done like that. Nothing gets done written on the back of a cigarette box. It all gets done through a proper lawyer, a qualified sort of property lawyer as well, I believe, not the sort of Dennis Donato of accountants. A good quality property lawyer. I always lodge a caveat over the property as well. I'm a big fan of that. So I've always had a lawyer. I use Lewis O'Brien. He's from Melbourne. He's quite renowned in the area in that aspect. So I've never had an issue. I've had a vendor one time have a bit of a dispute about the transaction at the very end. The agreements and stuff we had in place were totally sufficient and it was all dismissed very quickly, I suppose.
Shows the importance of having that agreement in place, isn't it, just to fall back onto, because at the end of the day, things change and people change too.
People's thoughts change. Like, I suppose that particular transaction where we had that issue, the vendor didn't realise, shit, with a professional team in there, this could be done in 30 days. Like, we transformed a whole house in 30 days. We put it on the market and it sold. It sold in one day. We got the photos booked in. the agent brought someone around there before it was even lodged on realestate.com, unconditional contract done. So I think the vendor's thoughts were, we could have done that. We should have done that. Let's see what we can get out of them anyway.
Yeah.
And look, that's okay. Probably a small sense of jealousy, potentially.
Right. I'm just being cautious of the time, David. We got any more questions or I'm going to switch the gears?
I think you just be mindful. You asked him last time a few questions already. So,
did he ask questions?
Yeah, you did.
Let's try something different. All right. But you got any more questions before that?
No, I'm good.
All right. Dan, switching gears a little bit.
Yeah.
God, believe in them?
Look, I'm not religious. I'm not a religious type, but I don't know. There has to be something out there. There has to be something out there, I think.
It's either aliens or God.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to pick one.
Oh, aliens or God?
No, we just made it up. Aliens. Oceans. There's more to the oceans than we know.
I think so, yeah.
Like what?
Well, I don't know. Like, it's just that big. I don't know if everyone's explored everything, yeah. I don't know, like, what, yeah. I don't know. Like, you see some of their movies, like Aquaman, is there actually people down there? Who knows?
That's exactly what I was headed towards. Aquaman.
Where's your mind, Jace?
Ghosts or spirits?
Ghost, yes. Spirits, yes. I think so. I've had an experience one time where I was sleeping in bed. It's called something, I can't remember what it's called, but you're laying in bed and I felt a spirit sort of come through the front door, walk all the way through the kitchen, all the way around into sort of the bedroom, and I got pinned to the bed there and I was trying to break out of it. I could not break out of it until after a bit of force, I sort of broke out of it and what felt like was letting go of a balloon. The way the spirit sort of come into the room, I felt it go all the way outside and out the door. And when it sort of left the door, then I was able to jump up. I've had a bizarre thing like that happen. In that same house, my wife had been walking around there. There was a photo of my grandpa, and she was walking down there, and she's like, and she said to me in the morning, she's like, I seen your grandpa. And I was like, what do you mean? He's been dead longer than I've been alive, though. And then she's like, no, I seen him and he said everything's fine. And, yeah, so I think there's stuff out there. I really do. I haven't seen nothing scary or anything like that. I've never been into doing seances and all that sort of stuff. But, hey, I like watching scary movies and ghost movies and, like, The Exorcist, Emily Rose movies and stuff like that. It's pretty cool.
I was about to ask, did you watch a scary movie that night and it wasn't a dream, maybe?
No. It wasn't like, it was just a normal night that happened. I freaked out. But I've spoken to it a few people. I'll give you another story. When we moved into another property after that, I lived right near a cemetery, right? Like, you can see the cemetery just across the road. And we kept noticing when I was renovating the house, like, you'd go back there the next day and bedroom light would be on, or the laundry door would be open, or some doors of the kitchen would be open, and you're like, and I kept saying to the carpenter, we kept rocking up there at the same time, did you close that door? And he's like, yeah, I did. We started noticing stuff like this happening that much that we started like laughing it off, but it, like, we'd be walking around the house going, mate, make sure you close all this, make sure you do all this. And we had a checklist of everything, like, to make sure it was all done. You come back the next day and the front window was all open. And you're like, how the hell does this all happen? Then we moved into that house for a little bit and we kept noticing these flowers getting sat down in the middle of the front yard. And we're like, how the hell does that happen? We kept hearing the washing machine kept opening up. Yeah, like, the door of the washing machine kept opening up. Me and my wife were, like, freaking out about it. I was at work one time and I was speaking to a guy and I was telling him about this and he goes, Daniel, I know this is going to sound crazy, but go home and say in the top of your lungs, I know you're here, we don't want you here, please leave. And I was like, this guy thinks he's fucking crazy. So I went home and I done it. And no joke, it disappeared. Like we had no more weird things. We had no more flowers on the front yard or anything like that. It was
So hang on. Was this at the same house?
This was not at the same house where I got pinned and my wife seen my grandpa. This was at the same house where we done all the renovations and the washing machine kept opening up. Yeah,
basically the one that you can see the symmetry from.
Opposite, across the road. Yeah, and that's what it was more scary about too. Because you'd be there at nighttime working and stuff, and you know you got the symmetry right there and. Oh, mate, I can tell you more stories from there. Yeah.
Go for it. I got another 3 minutes left. If you go for it.
All right. This one here wasn't, this wasn't a ghost, but this was a, I don't know if it was someone possessed by something. My brothers picked me up from work one time and they're driving down the road there to come and pick me up and a guy come running out of the cemetery. Running out of the cemetery about 4 o'clock and he had a big knife on him sort of thing. And, they drove off and the guy went along and then jumped in a big van and started chasing him. Like, it was a bizarre place to live. I went there, I drove past there the other day and went and seen the next door neighbours and they've moved out of there. Yeah, so.
Oh, man.
It was a bizarre house, but. I liked the house. It was actually cool. Yeah, we renovated it quite nice. It was a beautiful home. But it was hard to sell too because of the cemetery. It was amazing. A lot of the Indians and stuff like that, and that's probably one of the main people that would buy in that area, they wouldn't buy it just purely because of the cemetery. It didn't bother me. I wouldn't move back to a place like that again, I don't think.
Well, just don't tell the address on the podcast.
Wow, that's some story, mate. Seriously.
I literally just pulled out 3 questions randomly, mate. Got the kick here.
It's a good series, mate. Jazz, you got to keep going next time. He's going to calm down.
Jazz, we got to do an episode just on this, mate, to go
in. Yeah.
Now the sprites and goes in the property investment journey.
That's all good. But on a serious note, Dan, do appreciate your time, mate, for discussing your journey last time and this time as well. I think there's a lot to learn from your story. Not many people will come out and share the kind of story that you had. So, learning. Well, he survived and he's moving ahead in the game.
He's a survivor. He's not only a property survivor, he's now a ghost survivor too, man.
All right, boys. Well, thanks a lot.
Take care. And to our listeners, we'll see you guys next time. Cheers, Jazz and David. Thanks, Dan.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.